Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 377. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 445 on the Chester-class scout cruisers of the US Navy, the fairly well-received Wednesday video on the Battle of the Philippine Sea, Hellcat Ascendancy, and the Friday video on the Swedish mine layer Bremon. Almirante Brown asks, why did the Royal Navy choose a relatively clumsy six-gun broadside in awkward open single mounts for the Hawkins class? Could the Royal Navy have instead built them with all seven of their 7.5-inch guns in splinter-proof one-gun and two-gun turrets on the centre line? And if so, what sacrifices would have to be made to protection and speed? So one thing you've got to bear in mind is the context of when the Hawkins class are designed. They're designed and laid down in the early to middle part of World War One, so there is a bit of a rush on to get them constructed. And therefore, there isn't any existing modern twin 7.5-inch turret for them to base themselves off. There have only ever been single 7.5-inch mounts, some a bit like you see in the Hawkins with minimal protection, and some like you might find on, say, the Devonshire class with a bit more protection, but they're full-on armoured cruisers. There have been twin 6-inch turrets, like on the Monmouths, and there have been twin 9.2-inch, like on the Minotaurs, but nothing for the 7.5-inch. And at the time, at least for these smaller guns, and bear in mind the 7.5-inch was chosen in part because it was considered that was the largest gun that could be hand-operated. Okay, two people needed to carry the shell, but you didn't need any power assistance to run the 7.5s. Whereas if you'd gone with a twin turret for the 7.5, now suddenly that gun set, or gun mounting and turret together, would be too large and too heavy for manual only working. You'd have to incorporate power working, and that A, would cost more weight, and B, introduce vulnerability in the event of, you know, in a cruiser fight with potentially lots of smaller shells coming in. If you lost the connection for the power, then you could be in a lot of trouble. Another factor to consider was, again, because they're anticipating, especially in the middle of World War One, based on war experience, that cruiser fights might actually entail quite a lot of small caliber hits. If you don't have an armoured turret, and obviously an armoured turret is going to incur additional weight and stability penalties, then having multiple guns grouped together, say in twin mountings or twin turrets, means that a single hit could knock out two guns, whereas having everything spaced out in single gun mountings could give you the ability to only just lose one gun if that gun happens to be hit and the others stay in operation. Ultimately, you know, yes, you've got a six-gun broadside, but you've only got seven guns. You've only got two wing guns, so it's not that inefficient. And another consideration they had to bear in mind was that the specific scenario the Hawkins class were designed for, which was long-distance commerce, patrol, and defence, they were anticipating, again, based on wartime experience, that initial exchanges of gunfire would occur at long range, followed by a long chase. And in those circumstances, they felt that having the wing-mounted 7.5s would offer more forward firepower for a chase. And obviously, if the target's evading and you're having to course correct, you can bring one or the other wing mount to bear, as opposed to putting one of these 7.5s in an amidships position, perhaps immediately behind the second funnel or between the two funnels. Because while in theory that would save you the weight of a gun and give you exactly the same broadside, if you're on a very fine chase line, that gun wouldn't be able to bear ahead. So almost some argument similar to why Fisher in the end went for wing mounts on Dreadnought as well. And ultimately, when it comes to Royal Navy cruisers, you've got to bear in mind that it wasn't until the Emerald class or the E class and the post-war experiments with the twin 6-inch turret that the Royal Navy really started to move to multi-gun turrets for their cruisers, at least outside of, you know, the occasional thing on something like the Monmouth or the Minotaurs. But the reason I mentioned the timing as well is that without an existing 7.5-inch twin mounting to go on, they'd have to design and test one. And they thought, at least, that they needed these ships ASAP, so they didn't think they had the time to build and test such a mount. Now, in theory, they could have gotten away with a similar broadside, if not better, by adopting twin mounts. So, for example, if you eliminated the wing mountings and the aftmost gun, and then you replace the two aft turrets or mounts with twin mounts, and then replaced the forwardmost, so A mounting, with a twin and left the super firing or B mounting a single, then you still have seven guns and a seven gun broadside, but you've eliminated three of the gun positions. And it's probably not going to cost you a huge amount in terms of weight or stability. And you also retain a minimum three gun forward salvo. And of course, if you upgraded B mounting to a twin as well, so you had four twin 7.5s, then you have a ship that now has eight guns, four of which can fire dead ahead across a wide set of angles, so better than the setup they have with the existing design, and it gives you an eight-gun broadside instead of a six-gun broadside. Now, of course, you might incur some small weight penalties, but the larger impact will probably be the stability penalties of having the super-firing mounts go over to twins, because obviously twins instead of singles, that's a fair bit of extra weight and stability up top. But there are potential workarounds to that. So, for example, if you delete the aftmost 7.5-inch position, then, as you can see with the armor layout, you don't need to necessarily take the armor all the way aft. Additionally, as you can see, the super-firing aft position is on kind of its own little bandstand because there's some 3-inch next to it. Now, in the event that we don't have the wing mounts, you could actually just eliminate that bandstand altogether. So you drop the now twin 7.5-inch mount down one deck level, which would save you a fair bit on stability. And then you could relocate those 3-inch guns and potentially even the bandstand with a 4-inch HA that's around the mainmast. You could potentially relocate all of those, and as well as the little bandstand that's between the funnels, and have your 3-inch and 4-inch all along the wings instead of the wing 7.5s. And that would save enough weight and stability that I think overall it probably wouldn't make too much odds compared to the existing weight and stability of the Hawkins as they came out. But that whole thing is predicated on having a quickly and easily accessible twin 7.5-inch mount, which they didn't have, and also the implications of making them powered mounts, and that may push the weight up. Although, again, it's how much weight and stability are you saving by deleting the bandstands and that aft mount and the associated armor relative to how much are you adding? It's, that's a calculation that would require quite a lot of detail. Third Base asks, you've mentioned that some World War II era submarines were designed to be able to fire their torpedoes using their passive sonar, aka their hydrophones, or later actually genuine full-on passive sonar later on, but nonetheless. What was the deepest they could fire the torpedoes from, and did any submarine ever try this and get a hit? So most submarines at the start of World War II could, in theory, fire their torpedoes at any depth, because bear in mind, obviously, the torpedo, if it's fired at a depth, would just pop up rather than dive down, in the case of a surface or air-launched torpedo, to its requisite depth and carry along quite happily. And you even have instances of submarines being designed, and then someone goes, actually, you know what, we're going to make the pressure hull a little bit stronger so it can go a bit deeper. And then someone going, hang on a minute. If we're going to do that, we need to also change the torpedo tube doors so that they can stand up to the pressure of being flooded at this new requisite depth. Otherwise, we might end up flooding our torpedo tubes at, theoretically, the submarine's operational depth, and then the clips or whatever fail and suddenly the sub is flooded. Of course, you only flood your tubes normally when you are preparing to launch your torpedoes. So, that's kind of a fairly easy inferred capability. And in terms of specifically trained to attack that way, some submarines definitely, and some navies definitely did, at least initially, try for this. The US Navy, for instance, actually with the TDC, decided that, hey, actually, we think maybe, you can go down 100, 150 feet. Obviously, that's not the full operational depth of a Gato class, but this was the depth they thought would be a good idea, because obviously the deeper you go, the more force you have to expend to kick the torpedo out. But anyway, they thought, go down 100, 150 feet, take your bearings using hydrophones, use the TDC to work out the what you need to do for the settings of the torpedoes, and then fire the torpedoes. Then you're not at periscope depth, no one can see you, and by the time the torpedo gets shallow enough for a bubble trail that can be followed to form, you're already quite a way away. Sounds great in principle. Of course, in practice, basically what happened was they found out very quickly that with the sensitivity and number of hydrophone arrays fitted onto early World War II subs, you couldn't guarantee accuracy really all that much. The bearings that you got were a little bit too fuzzy. The way they got around that with the R class in the Royal Navy in World War I was firstly by shooting a whole load of torpedoes and also having loads of hydrophones, which would obviously allow you to cross-check bearings. Whereas submarines at the beginning of World War II, not being designed as hunter-killers, tended to have, well, it depends on exactly which sub you're talking about, but it could be as few as one, more often maybe two, maybe three hydrophones, and the resolution and everything just wasn't there. As time went on, of course, both through practice and improved technology, they did get more precise. But even towards the end of the Second World War, it was still better to get a visual and or radar fix on your target. And generally speaking, if you were going quite deep, you were generally trying to evade your enemy, at which point firing a torpedo would be a big giveaway to anybody with a half-working hydrophone array of their own on an escort. Plus, in the case of some subs, like the later German U-boats, the actual operational depth had increased quite significantly as well. Now, that's not to say people didn't try, especially desperation shots when they are being pursued by escorts. But as far as I'm immediately aware, and of course, if people know specific events, please mention them in the comments, but as far as I'm immediately aware, the only torpedoes that were fired from any great depth that had any significant chance of hitting and did occasionally score hits were the acoustic homing torpedoes used by the Germans in the latter stages of World War II. Because, of course, most of the concerns we've just outlined about, you know, the exact resolution of your target bearing and everything don't apply quite as much to a torpedo that can change its course and home in on its target after launch. So if you are a German U-boat and you're running and you're diving, you've maybe gone down 200, 250 feet and you're heading still deeper, and you happen to have an acoustic homing torpedo loaded in your stern tube, you might as well fire that off, because even if you've only got a bearing that's maybe a degree or two or three in terms of resolution, that'll be close enough for, theoretically, the acoustic homing torpedo to pick up the signal of the ship that's closing in on you and then home in on it and hopefully damage or to sink it so that you are no longer being pursued. Fiona F. asks, as a native of Shoreham-by-Sea in Sussex, I'm always interested in local history. Could you tell me about the impact our little port has had on naval history and the impact of the few HMS Shorehams of the Royal Navy? I believe some of the early frigates were constructed locally, but I've not found much information beyond that. Okay, so Shoreham, for those of you who aren't aware, is on the south coast of the UK, somewhat to the east of Portsmouth, and just immediately west of Brighton. It has quite a long history, and it was quite important as a port in the medieval times. It wasn't one of the original Cinque ports, although as a rule generally, the Cinque ports were the ones further east along towards the Dover Straits, but that's a separate issue. And Shoreham had quite a number of shipyards, as you noted, and they built a lot of merchant vessels and some warships. So this, you can see here, this is HMS Dover from the early part of the Age of Sail. She's pretty much the biggest warship that was built. She's a two-decker. Depending on exactly how you rate her, she's either a very, very, very heavy fifth rate or a small fourth rate. But the vast majority of warships that were built in Shoreham dockyards were frigates and unrated vessels, fireships, sloops, brigs, that kind of thing. And the main reason for this was because Shoreham, if you look up on a map, is essentially a port that relies on the River Adur. I think that's how the river is pronounced anyway, which flows into the sea basically, well, originally just to the west of Shoreham. And originally is kind of the problem because as time went on, the River Adur interacting with Shoreham Beach and the local landscape and silt and so forth tended to wander back and forth, leaving a lot of shallow mud flats and, you know, the level of access that you had both to the port and to the sea could vary quite a bit. And that limited the size of ships that could get into and out of the port, limited the size of ships that therefore you could build there. And in by the 19th century, when they decided to do some fairly significant engineering works and go, right, no, the river is coming out here and it's staying here, mostly so that they could put some harbour quays or piers. Well, they're not quays because you don't really dock there, but basically protective barriers up plus a fort to defend it all. By that point, ships had gotten of a size such that it was now actually rather difficult, if not impossible, to build the largest warships in Shoreham at all, even if you'd wanted to. And so Shoreham never builds, you know, full two-deck, three-deck, second, first-rate ships of the line, but does contribute quite a lot of smaller ships, and it can continue contributing merchant ships, because by and large the merchant ships are somewhat smaller than the warships. But as you move on through the latter part of the 19th century, even that starts to dry up because, well, merchant ships are also getting larger, and also shipbuilding is moving over from the old wooden construction over to iron construction, and that requires a whole load of additional industry and infrastructure, which Shoreham didn't have and didn't have the size to justify other people setting up as compared to some of the other ports in the UK. And so shipbuilding in Shoreham, outside of, you know, private yachts and other small-scale stuff like that, died off in the latter part of the 19th century. And as for HMS Shoreham's, well, there have been two frigates, one sloop, and a current minesweeper that all go by the name of HMS Shoreham. The frigates and the sloop have had reasonably decent success. The frigates took a number of prizes. The sloop helped to sink at least two submarines, as far as I'm aware of, possibly more. And obviously the minesweeper is still active at the moment. One of the things, although obviously there haven't been that many ships called HMS Shoreham, is that none of them have been lost, either to enemy action or to the wind and the waves. One of the frigates came close, it did go aground, but every single HMS Shoreham has lived out its full service life in the Royal Navy and then been sold on to other uses, whether to the breakers or as a private ship or whatever. But basically, if you went to sea on an HMS Shoreham, the ship itself would always come home. Captain Seafort asks, after the Chester class, the US Navy spent most of the next decade banging on correctly about needing more cruisers, and my understanding is they at least had sketch designs worked out. If either Congress had been willing to part with a bit more money, or the US Navy had been willing to sacrifice a capital ship or two to pay for them, how do you think these designs would have compared with their British and German contemporaries? So this period of US cruiser design is actually really interesting. In the period between the Chesters and the Omahas, US cruiser design takes three primary routes. The longest and most consistent route is a continued obsession with the scout cruiser. It very rapidly gets bigger because when the Chesters come into service, as I kind of alluded to in the video, the US Navy kind of looked at it and went, that's not a good thing in the current environment. So very rapidly, the scout cruiser designs they're preparing grow to sort of 7,000-8,000 tons and more. This is a fairly typical example of something they came up with at the time. And as you can see, there are shades of what would eventually actually become the Omahas here. Those are cage lattice masts. So in some ways, it's probably just as well for our eyes that they weren't built. But you can see, while they've got two single 6-inch aft, they've got this mixture of open mount and casement mounted 6-inch all forward to provide quite a heavy forward firepower, but as it's split between casement and deck mounted, which you will actually again see in the Omahas. So this example has 8 6-inch guns total plus some torpedoes. Now, this would indicate, you know, there was an obsession with speed as well as a considerable amount of firepower. You can see there is an armor belt there, but a lot of the other designs they come up with are basically giant protected cruisers. This one has a 4-inch belt, so it's not quite as bad as some of the others. But they really are obsessed primarily with speed, then with firepower, and then sort of trailing a distant third protection. But the sheer size of them means that the protection is still okay. And when I say okay, I mean okay for its size. Obviously, a 4-inch belt is considerably thicker than that you'll find on contemporary German cruisers or even British. You know, the C class, the D class, the World War I Towns, they all have slightly thinner belts. But this is also a ship that's going to displace almost twice as much as the C class. So you'd be looking at ships that were individually quite powerful and quite quick compared to their British and German contemporaries, but you wouldn't have that many of them. For example, even when the US Navy was actually asking for them, they were asking for 4 in a year rather than the, you know, 8, 10, 12 that you'd see the British or the Germans laying down. Now, this is the main drift of what they're looking at, but around about the time period that they actually come up with this particular design, they actually start abandoning this idea. They kind of put it on ice until the development of the Omahas and the immediate preceding designs, which is what, in part, why this so closely resembles an Omaha to some degree. Because in the early to mid-1910s, the US Navy basically throws its hands up in the air and goes to Congress, well, you know what, if you're not going to fund even our reasonable request for 4 scout cruisers in a given year, then you know what? We're just going to draw up a bunch of stuff that we really, really want, because, hey, if you're going to say no to everything, you might as well say no to something that we'd really actually like. And that leads to the other two lines of development, one of which is full-on battle cruisers. So for people who might tell you, oh, the US never signed up to battle cruisers, no, they absolutely did. The US Navy signed up to battle cruisers in a big way. They just never got the money for them. There are loads of US battlecruiser designs out there, and that will be a very interesting video at some point in the future. But they're just not given the money to build them. And the other thing which they also look into in a big way is kind of a hybrid between the scout cruiser and the battlecruiser, something that would make even Admiral Fisher, with the Courageous class, look at them and go, oh, hang on a bit. basically, you know, the Courageous style, hey, we've stuck a couple or 4 big heavy guns, in the US case either 14 or 16 inch, on a really light hull and sent it charging across the ocean with basically no armor but insane levels of speed. Yeah, that wasn't unique to Fisher. The US Navy did draw up a whole ton of designs based on pretty much that concept as scout cruisers, basically going all out on the firepower and the speed. I mean, if they ran across anything that actually had capital ship grade guns to fire back at it, they would have lost about 4 seconds, 3 of which would have been the opponent wondering what the heck they'd run into. But they are very, very interesting designs, pretty much, you know, mirrors of the Courageous class. Although, given that they are designed in roughly the same time period, I don't think one is influencing the other. I think it's in some ways almost a mutual convergent evolution of designs, although for slightly different purposes. BK Zhong asks, if the Japanese Navy actually had significant numbers of trained pilots left by the time of the Battle of the Philippine Sea, would that have been enough to partially mitigate the superiority of the F-6F Hellcat over prior American or Japanese carrier-based fighters? It certainly would have helped. If you watch through the Battle of the Philippine Sea video, some of the things that will stand out to you where experienced pilots really, really could have helped is the fact that, well, when the Japanese were launching their strikes, they were having to time and launch their strikes where the few remaining pilots they had who were good at open water navigation were basically leading all the other pilots to the targets. Now, obviously, that compromises exactly how and when you can launch your strike. If everybody can navigate, then you could potentially launch much faster concerted strikes like the Japanese had been doing in 1942. Plus, you don't have to have this long straggling line of aircraft playing follow the leader. You can actually maintain some form of actual coherent formation because everybody knows where they're going. And then related to that, of course, is the fact that if everybody is in a coherent formation, when they arrive in range of the target, they can just continue to attack that target rather than spending 10, 15 minutes circling around pointlessly 50 to 70 miles away, desperately trying to regain some form of coherent formation, giving the Hellcats vital time to get airborne for those that weren't already in the combat air patrol and get altitude and, you know, lay into the Japanese aircraft. And then, of course, if you have experienced pilots, even when the Hellcats attack, they might stand a slightly better chance of fighting back. So if you had essentially the trained pilot corps of 1942 at the Philippine Sea, then they would have taken off and gotten airborne formations a lot faster. They would have held those formations. Then when they reached the sort of 50, 70, 80 miles away from the target, they would have just kept going, which would then mean that the initial combat air patrol interceptions would be taking place considerably closer to the ships. Ship-launched fighters would maybe get, if they're lucky, one or two attack passes in before the attack commences, rather than having, you know, 5-10 minutes of free airtime to go after the Japanese aircraft time and time again. So you'd have more, considerably more Japanese aircraft actually arriving to conduct their attacks. And as they conduct those attacks, obviously with more experienced pilots in the zeros and so forth, the Hellcats also, even in that limited window, wouldn't get quite as many attacks successfully in because they'd have to be defending themselves. So, I mean, there would still be a fairly heavy slaughter of Japanese aircraft, but there would, with significant numbers of trained pilots present, there is a much, much better chance that the Japanese might actually exact some pain on the American formations in exchange for the decimation of their air arm once again. Especially, I mean, pretty much any of the attack waves, but especially the last one that kind of got a little bit lost and came in from an unexpected angle. If that thing had been made up of fully trained veteran pilots, they could have done a lot more damage than they historically did. Jesse Trada asks, if a small nation wanted a flat top for whatever reason, could they have used a light carrier as a fleet carrier intentionally? Because maybe, you know, that's the biggest thing their port could handle? I.e., is there a realistic scenario? Is this a realistic scenario, or are small carriers just not viable without larger fleet carriers also around? It's entirely possible to use a light carrier as the flagship of your navy. It really depends on what you want to do with it, though. So, for example, here is the USS Cabo, or Cabo, possibly, cosplaying as the Spanish carrier Didalo. It actually was the Spanish carrier Didalo for a good long while. And as you can see, it's an Independence-class light carrier. And as you can see, it was around for quite a bit. And yes, those are Harrier jump jets on the back of it. So you absolutely can operate a small modern air wing off of a light carrier. And indeed, the Dutch, the French, the Canadians, the Australians, as well as a number of others, they would all operate light fleet carriers of various descriptions, mostly British, to be fair, even the Argentinians at that point, for fleet flagships. And they could project a certain amount of power out there, because ultimately, if you can put some strike aircraft, an ASW aircraft out there, and your opponent cannot, you win. Unless your opponent has ridiculous amounts of anti-aircraft capability. But so, yeah, you absolutely can operate light fleet carriers as your only carriers in your navy, although obviously it does help if you are allied with other powers who might have bigger carriers with even more aircraft, because then you can operate in concert with them. But even if you're fighting on your own, you, as I said, will have a significant advantage, or at least a good defense, potentially, against somebody else who either doesn't have a carrier or doesn't have an operational one. You do obviously, though, have to cut your cloth accordingly, because, you know, if you're the US and you show up off of some random part of the Soviet Union in the middle of the Cold War with four supercarriers, you can probably conduct a fairly intensive air campaign and defend yourself fairly well. If, however, you just have your one light fleet carrier, I wouldn't necessarily advise taking on like four heavy bomber regiments with that. It's not going to end well for you. Conversely, if, however, some annoying South American country has just tried to take one of your islands, like, say, in the Falklands, and all you have is an old light fleet carrier and a modern through-deck cruiser, honestly not a light fleet carrier, Governor, then it turns out that, well, having that small amount of air cover is actually pretty much the make or break for your entire campaign, aka the 1982 Falklands War. And yes, at that point, the Argentinians did have Venta Cinco de Mayo, which ironically was, of course, a former British light fleet carrier, but thanks to a combination of submarine and weather operations, plus the sinking of the Belgrano, she never actually got to engage in combat with her opposite number. So that meant that as far as the British were concerned in the Falklands, they were proving the concept of, hey, if you've got a light fleet carrier or two light carriers, essentially, that can, if you're operating against, say, a land-based opponent that doesn't have a massive air force, be the thing that safeguards your fleet, to a degree. Bonsai Blacksmith asks, do you have a video explaining the pros and cons of the different styles of deck, i.e. broken versus sweeping versus flush, etc.? I don't at the moment, but that's definitely going on the list as one of my naval engineering videos, because I think that would actually be quite interesting. But for the purposes of a dry dock answer, the short version in sort of the highlight crude terms would be you're trading weight and stability off against strength and volume or capacity, depending on how you want to look at it. So here's a county class cruiser, flush deck design. Most of the ships that you'll see that have a broken deck will either have a very high forecastle, so this is more common perhaps on destroyers and smaller cruisers, and then you'll have a break in the deck somewhere around the bridge area, and then everything else will be low. And as you go to bigger ships, you know, the larger cruisers that aren't flush deckers like this one, and some capital ships, then you'll have the forecastle being high, these amidships portion being high, and then it'll drop back down somewhere in the aft third of the ship. So what you gain by having a broken deck design is weight saving, because obviously if you have a flush deck design like this with the county class, you have a minimum height which you need for decent freeboard, which is mostly going to be dominated by the bow. And then if you maintain roughly that height all the way along, then obviously you're adding a whole bunch of weight relatively high in the ship, at least as far as the hull is concerned. So your hull is going to weigh more, and that's obviously also going to have effects on stability. But also, if you look at something like, say, since we're using a British ship as an example, look at a standard type town class, not Belfast or Edinburgh, because they are slightly different, but look at an original flavour town class, and you'll notice that you have A and B turrets, like you have the A and B turrets here on the county class, but then X and Y turret, X, the superfiring turret, is actually at the same level as A turret, and Y turret, the lower of the two, is a deck lower than even A turret, which is the lowest of the forward turrets. And while obviously the turrets all weigh the same, you are saving a fraction in weight by having slightly shorter barbettes aft, but also making some more stability savings because, of course, your big heavy main battery aft is now, both turrets are now one deck lower than the corresponding turrets are up front. So this is all good reasons to, you know, have your broken deck. However, as we said, you do have issues of strength and capacity. So in terms of capacity, obviously a hull like this has a lot of internal volume, and therefore you can have, relatively speaking, for a warship, luxurious accommodations, additional stores and supplies, larger messes, etc., etc. So that can make your ship far more suitable for long-distance operations, because you can store more stuff and more people in slightly greater comfort down below. Also, if you're looking at the larger vessels, so vessels that you're thinking might actually end up in a big fleet engagement, having a flush deck hull and thus being able to store a lot of stuff in that hull means that you can actually minimize the superstructure, because ultimately if you want ships to do certain things, you might have to store a certain minimum amount of people and supplies. And if you don't have the space in the hull, then your superstructure usually will grow to accommodate that. And superstructures can be fairly significant shell traps when it comes to big long-distance gunnery duels. But the other thing is strength. So looking at it from a very crude engineering perspective, a flush deck design like this, essentially the hull is forming one big box girder. So it's a pretty strong hull form. It's not going to break very easily, and therefore you can theoretically put a lot of stress and strain on it in terms of armament, stuff up top, loads at sea, armor plating, etc., and it should hold up. Whereas if you go for a broken deck design, wherever that deck breaks, wherever it steps down, that is a focal point of stress. And obviously the box girder that the lower portion of the hull is made up of doesn't have the same depth as the taller portion, and therefore will be inherently slightly less strong anyway. So over time, both in terms of general wear and tear and fatigue, and especially in terms of battle damage, stresses will be accumulated around that break. And potentially you could end up with structural failure there in certain circumstances where exactly the same level of stress damage or battle hits might not break a flush deck design. So that is something you do have to bear in mind for especially warships. James Beeching asks, what is the difference between a minesweeper and a mine hunter? Essentially, it comes down to the method by which you are able to hunt mines. And I'm not saying the method by which you do hunt mines, because a mine hunter can act as a minesweeper, but a minesweeper, you cannot act as a mine hunter, if those are the original design specifications. So what I mean by this is that a minesweeper does what you might call a passive operation. So it's going to use things like paravanes and such like. So it has to go through a minefield and make some kind of physical contact with the mines, obviously ideally with using the paravane cables or other similar tools, to engage the mines, free them, and then dispose of them, usually by gunfire. Whereas a mine hunter can proactively go out and hunt down mines without necessarily having to physically put itself at risk. So with a minesweeper, the only way to actually engage with the mines is to physically put yourself in the minefield and use your equipment. Whereas a mine hunter, using a combination of sonar and other techniques, plus in more recent times things like off-board ROVs and so forth, can go out and locate a mine with its sonar from a safe distance and then send something out to go out and actually, you know, blow it up or make it inert or whatever. So that's why a mine hunter can be a mine sweeper, because technically, even if you are a mine hunter, there's nothing stopping you putting a set of paravane sweeps out and trawling through a minefield if you absolutely want to. In theory, you could use your sonar to make sure the little path that you're going down is very safe and secure. But of course, something that's fitted purely as a mine sweeper cannot then also be a mine hunter, because it won't have stuff like the active sonar systems and so forth on board. The other thing I would note is that if you are a minesweeper, you are basically relying on some form of interfaceable element of the mine to be able to engage with it. So anchor chains or cables or something like that. Whereas if you're a mine hunter, you can go after mines that are just sitting quite happily inert on the seabed, waiting for something to come along, which a minesweeper normally can't really deal with. Penguin Cannon 9000 asks, in Drydock 299, well, that was a while ago, you mentioned that you were making a paper on the loss of HMS Hood. I've never heard of it until now, and in the years since then, how much progress have you actually made on that paper? I think it's now in a state where I'm finally happy to submit it for publication. As I alluded to back in Drydock 299, one of the wonderful things with naval history research, particularly with that particular paper, is that every time you think you've got all the relevant details down, you discover something new. So, for example, back when I originally wrote up the paper as a companion piece to my video on the loss of HMS Hood, I wasn't aware that the US Navy had independently discovered the bow wave and trough problem during their design of the North Carolina class. I discovered that several months after I'd published the video. Now, it doesn't fundamentally change the points and assertions that I made in that video, but it is a nice confirmatory element to include in that, you know, this is not something that is just a theory of mine. The Admiralty looked at it as well, but also the fact that not only is this kind of separate third-party confirmation that this actually does happen, this, you know, bow wave leading to a trough, which can lead to a vulnerable low point in the water alongside a ship, but it's confirmed by a completely independent third party, because obviously the US Navy has no particular interest in confirming or denying in the early 1930s what is or isn't a vulnerability of HMS Hood. They are, however, very interested in doing model tests of the North Carolina's hull form and going, ah, that's a problem. I don't want a shell punching through this nice little trough in the water and straight into my magazines. This will end badly. So they have to, you know, do a little bit of a post-design bodge job on the North Carolinas to try and mitigate that. You know, as I say, it's good third-party confirmation. Didn't know that at the time I published the video, but then they have to include it in the paper. And since Drydock 299, I've had, I think, three further little sort of things which have, I've had to go back and go, okay, now I have to work out how to include these in the paper. One of which, unsurprisingly, was most recently the letter from the survivor from HMS Prince of Wales, which offers some nice, neat insights that are worth including. Another, including particularly, obviously, the fact that Hood did not change course. Another element is the, I wouldn't say necessarily new, but further confirmation of a point. So some people who prefer to believe against most of the available evidence that Hood was a good way through her turn, have this thing of, oh, there's some kind of special halyard that you can fly, which denotes that you should follow orders immediately rather than waiting for them to be hoisted down. Now, immediately when I heard that, I thought that is nonsense, because for one thing, you would be flying signal flags not from a specific halyard, but from whichever halyards could hold those signal flags based on where you are. So, you know, if your people you're signaling to are on your port side, you're hoisting from your port halyards. If they're on the starboard side, you're hoisting from the starboard halyards. If the halyards take damage from shell fragments or the weather, you're going to have to hoist from different halyards. And also, we're talking about distances of miles where these signals are being observed by, okay, powerful, but still binoculars with smoke and spray and other things affecting, you know, the ability to make things out precisely through visual recognition. No one is going to be staring at these signals and going, oh, do you know what? Do you think that's on the first halyard or the second? Or is it on the third or the fourth? I can't quite tell. It could make all the difference. It doesn't make any sense. And indeed, the evidence I had at the time also said, no, this is absolutely not a thing. So I was quite confident in that going at the time. But since then, I've actually gone out and acquired copies of every single major edition of the Admiralty Manual of Signalling for the entire period that Hood was in service with the Royal Navy, and immediately thereafter for the rest of the Second World War in the 1940s, because obviously they don't reissue a brand new revised edition every year, but there's quite a few editions if you want to go from World War One through to the start of the Cold War. And now, having gone through every single one of them, they're quite long, I can absolutely confirm that nowhere in any Admiralty manual of signalling for that period, nor in any of the Admiralty fighting instructions, is there ever a specification that I've found written down that says, oh, if you want your orders to be followed immediately upon hoisting the signal, then you hoist the flag from this specific halyard. I can categorically say in World War II, it was not a thing. I knew that already, but now I can categorically prove it. Now, of course, you could have some kind of custom arrangement where you tell people beforehand, okay, in battle, if I hoist this signal or that signal, I want you to follow it immediately. But that is a prearranged thing, and that is the kind of thing that, you know, Captain Leach on Prince of Wales would mention in his testimony if it had been a thing. It also, you know, goes completely against every single thing that Hood had been doing up to that point, because this was not the first two blue signal that Hood had actually been flying. She had hoisted and hauled down a couple of them beforehand, and Prince of Wales had been acting in proper accordance with the normal way that you conduct two blue signals, which is that you haul them down to indicate the execution of the signal. And in the course of my investigations, I did, in fact, end up finding reference to how to fly a signal order flag in a way that does indicate it being executed immediately. But one, that comes from a NATO code signalling book from, obviously, into the Cold War period. And two, it does still doesn't talk about any kind of special unique halyard. It instead talks about hoisting the signal flag A from your first halyard, because you can tell relative order of halyards, because obviously and that flag's to the left of the other one. So you hoist A as your first, and then on a subsequent halyard, you hoist your signal. So at least in the early Cold War, under NATO signaling terms, that meant this order, but immediately, don't wait for the signal to be hauled down. But that is a very specific NATO signal. As I say, I can't find anything in the Royal Navy manuals of signaling for World War One, interwar period, World War Two, that has that similar thing. And also, there's zero evidence that Hood was flying any kind of qualifier to Two Blue at the time of her destruction. Every account just says she's flying Two Blue. So now that I have all of that backing me up, I can far more categorically and strongly state that that was absolutely not a thing. And then the final thing, since Drydock 299, was I had a little bit of a, oh, yeah, of course, slap myself upside the head moment, because one of the other things that sometimes is raised as an issue is the fact that when Hood's wreck was found, her rudder is turned 20 degrees. And people are like, ah, yes, well, you know, Two Blue, 20 degrees turn to port, rudder's at 20 degrees. Clearly, this means she was through her turn. And I mean, as I pointed out in both the original video and various answers in the dry dock subsequently, that's not necessarily the case, because there is a certain lag time between the rudder going over and the ship actually beginning to turn. And this is obviously all supposing that the rudder actually stayed locked in place at the moment it froze, and that it hasn't been, you know, shifted by currents of water as the ship sank, or by the impact of the ship on the seabed or anything like that. But even assuming that that is exactly where the rudder froze in place at the time the shell hit, the sort of slap myself upside the head moment I came across was there's the immediate mental conflation of turn 20 degrees to port, rudder is at 20 degrees. That's not how ships work in combat scenarios. When you are in a combat scenario and you want to turn fairly sharpish. Hood's rudder is capable of turning considerably further than 20 degrees, you know, well past 30. How far past 30 depends on how far towards the stops you want to push it, but nonetheless, the general point being that if Hood is in the middle of her turn, her rudder is actually going to be over considerably more than 20 degrees to give her the fastest and best controlled turn possible, and then the rudder will be set back to the center line as she swings through that turn so that she can line up on her 20 degree turn. So ironically enough, what has been touted by some as evidence that Hood is in her turn actually turns out to be evidence, at least to me, that even more so that Hood wasn't in her turn. Because the only time that Hood's rudder would be at 20 degrees, i.e. two-thirds-ish of the way through going over to full, would either be while she was quite considerably through the turn and they were straightening the rudder back up in preparation for coming out of the turn, which nobody, as far as I'm aware, is advocating for, or it actually fits perfectly with my theory that she's right at the very, very, very beginning of starting the movements to begin her turn, i.e. the helmsman has started to put the wheel over, but the ship itself hadn't started to move, because for the rudder to reach an angle of about 20 degrees off of centre represents about 5 to 6 seconds, maybe slightly more, maybe slightly less, depending on the exact settings of a rudder beforehand, obviously. So the rudder is moving towards being at full when something happens that causes it to lock up in place, like, you know, a colossal explosion between where the rudder is and where the orders are being given to the rudder. And so if the rudder is only partway through being put over, then that means it's only just started being put over, which, you know, go back and see the full Hood video for the reasons why, but that basically aligns with Hood being right at the very start of her turn. And what about when I say at the start of her turn, i.e. she has started to make the various motions, including obviously putting the rudder over, that would initiate her turn. But due to inertia and all sorts of other factors, as laid out in Knight's Manual for Seamanship, she hasn't actually yet begun to physically move or out of position by much, if anything. Probably not anything at all. So, yeah, that as well is something I've had to make a note of. But now, hopefully, over the December break, I will finish polishing up all those inclusions, format it all, and then it'll be a case of submitting it, and then, given the size of the thing at this point, almost inevitably having to work out how to make a 3,000-4,000 word précis version for, you know, general publication alongside the full size version, which will be available for download somewhere. Brad in SoCal asks, based on what you learned on your trip to Japan, what advantages do you think Japan had in World War II with regard to port facilities or other natural advantages that support naval power? So based on what I saw and what I read while I was there, I think if I was going to pick three major advantages that Japan had with regards to supporting naval power, this, by the way, is Kurei Shipyard, or part of Kurei Shipyard, as it is these days. I would say, firstly, there was a fairly high proportion of the population that was in some way, shape or form seafaring, because they had a very heavy coastal-based population. So that made a reasonable pool of sailors to draw on, or potential sailors with some experience. And that combined with the fact that in the run-up to World War II, Japan was still within a lifetime's worth of the Meiji Restoration and had basically kick-started itself from almost but not quite feudal to modern industrial state in that time. It meant that there was, you know, a good portion of that population would have relatively little in the way of economic wealth, and therefore a navy could offer, comparatively speaking, decent wages for actually not a huge amount of expenditure, relatively speaking, on the government's part. So you could attract sailors. Second advantage, the inland sea meant that at least some of the port facilities, like Kure, were very well sheltered. You know, you've got full access to the inland sea. It's a, you know, full and proper shipbuilding facility, but it's relatively easy to guard the inland sea against potential attack, whether by air or by sea, because obviously by sea, you just need to blockade the entrances, and by air, well, you've got an entire island that's acting as a shield that you can put airfields on and so forth. Obviously, not everything has that protection, like Yokosuka or Sasebo, but a portion of the Japanese shipbuilding and port industry does have that protection. And then finally, I think the other thing would be Japan's history of land reclamation, because as you can probably tell from this photo, and well, at least from what I experienced in Japan, quite a lot of Japan is like this, certainly in the area south of Tokyo. There's a very narrow habitable strip along the coastline, and then it almost immediately goes up into the mountains you can just see there in the background. Now, that in turn meant that land reclamation, initially obviously for things like rice cultivation, for example, in Yokohama, was something that the Japanese were actually fairly well practiced in, even, you know, centuries before the Meiji Restoration. So when it came to needing port facilities, well, as you can tell from the background where the further back cranes are, there's not really any great potential of digging back into the landscape to extend your port facilities. But the Japanese were already very experienced in going, okay, we need more land for a purpose. We're just going to reclaim it from the sea. And that seems to be pretty much how most of their port facilities have grown, which actually allows for very flat, very well-planned port facilities. Elite Corsair asks, during the time period that this channel covers, were there any sailing warships that were particularly notable for their outstanding speed characteristics, and were any of those ships given special combat or operational orders because of that speed capability? Yes, but you do have to remember that in this time period, the speed of a ship, I mean, obviously there's a lot of factors that influence it, but one of the two biggest factors that will influence a ship's speed are obviously the overall design of the ship, its length to breadth ratio, its hull form, amount of sails carried, area, sail area, etc., etc., but also how the ship is trimmed and handled by the captain, because there are ships that fundamentally should be good sailors, but got reputations as terrible sailors until they were put in the hands of a new captain who went, the trim in here is absolutely wrong. Hang on, move this ballast here, move that ballast there. And oh, look, suddenly we're going a couple of knots faster than we ever were before. This is, you know, a good thing. Some of the US super frigates, for example, depending on the captain, have either a reputation as a terrible sailor or a reputation as a really fast sailor. It's exactly the same ship. It's just how it's trimmed and how it's handled. Now, to a certain degree, obviously, trim is still going to affect ships even in the modern era. But as ships get larger and larger and larger, it becomes harder for small mistakes in trim calculations to have a dramatic effect on the ship's overall speed. Whereas the same weight displaced in the wrong direction by the same amount in a, you know, 500,000, 1,500, 2,000 ton wooden ship is going to have a proportionally much greater effect. So with that all in mind, the reason I've chosen this particular painting as the background is that one example is the Endymion, famous for obviously going after and taking the USS President. And Endymion was essentially a British-built equivalent of a captured French ship, the Pomone, and she proved to be remarkably fast and well-armed, and therefore was detailed to certain missions that required a particularly fast and well-armed ship. She's just one example. There are a reasonable number of others. And also the other thing you've got to remember is that speed in the Age of Sail could, and to a certain extent after that as well, but especially in Age of Sail, could vary quite significantly depending on what ship you were in and what weather conditions you were in. So a frigate that would be the fastest thing on the planet in light to medium airs, as the seas get heavier and the waves get rougher and the wind gets stronger, might actually start to be overhauled by a stoutly built but still fairly hydrodynamic ship of the line, which can hold its course, hold its sails, and plow through the waves much, much better. So the fastest ship in light airs may be very, very different from what the fastest ship in a storm might be. Farenda Ritter asks, what was naval intelligence like in the Age of Sail? Would the peer powers be keeping a close eye on what was being designed? Would they try and track ship locations? And were there any acts of sabotage? It varied quite a bit, but you've got to obviously understand that back in those days, seeing a ship take place or take shape, you could get a rough idea of what its capabilities were going to be. But until it actually got in the water and was tested, it was more difficult to guess what it was going to be performing like. But, you know, navies, especially in periods of heightened tension, would keep an eye on the latest and greatest stuff that was being produced by other people. And it was actually relatively easy. The shipyards had some security to prevent acts of sabotage and so forth, but it was very easy to walk close enough or sail close enough to see what was under construction. And whether you did that or whether you paid a local to do that and then supply you with the information. And also to keep an eye on, like, how many ships do they have in reserve? How many are they building? How many do they have in active service? Get an idea of overall force levels. Listen to the local bar, inn and tavern chat. You know, which ships have difficult captains? Which ships companies are looking forward to the journey? Has anybody, you know, dropped a few hints about where they might be going that they probably shouldn't have done, and so forth? All of this basic intel was going on at a certain level, but also when it came to war, you could just sit off the coast and go, hey, I can just look into the port with a telescope if you were on blockade duty. In terms of trying to track ship locations, it depends. So you try and keep an eye if there's someone was rigging up a major expedition to go out somewhere, you'd try and keep an eye on that. And of course, you'd have people logging, oh, this ship has arrived in this port, to try and build a general picture of what's going on. But the communications lag that's present in the Age of Sail makes trying to keep up to date tracks of everybody's ships basically impossible, because, you know, yes, if you're an English intelligence officer, perhaps assigned to the blockade fleet off of Brest, you can keep an eye on how many ships are in port and maybe what kinds they are. But if some of those break the blockade and sail out, who knows where they're going. If they are going there, who knows how long it's going to take to get there. And when they do arrive, even if somebody reports their arrival that day, it's still going to take weeks to get back. And by the time it gets back, obviously they've had weeks to do other things and maybe in other places. So trying to track anything more granular than a big fleet is potentially going this way usually wasn't worth even trying. And as far as acts of sabotage went, you do occasionally get reports of some degree or other of sabotage, but normally that wasn't really much of a thing. Because apart from anything else, the technology is relatively speaking basic. It's put together in a very complex way, but it's not like you could, break a particularly vital bit of equipment and immobilize the ship. And, cutting through the rigging lines would take far too long. So your acts of sabotage would be limited to things like, can we set fire to this ship? Actually, surprisingly difficult, especially if you want to get away and live afterwards. And things like assassinating officers and so forth generally was frowned upon, partly because there's a bit of a holdover of the rules of chivalry and honor, and partly because if you do that to them, then they'll start doing that to you. And, operational security guarding naval officers and so forth, not really a thing back then. Seb Dove asks, during the Second World War, what were operational, i.e. non-combat losses like for each Navy's respective carrier branch, and were steps taken to mitigate the losses? Unfortunately, there's, apart from just looking at sheer overall numbers, there's not really a kind of each Navy's carrier's arm breakdown of these losses. Also, you could say in 1942, the Royal Navy lost this many aircraft to operational accidents, and the US Navy lost this many, and the Japanese Navy lost this many. That, in theory, could be done. But in terms of, what it was actually like, what steps can you do to mitigate those losses, that doesn't really tell you anything apart from we need this many new airframes. And the reason for that is that there was never really a consistent rate of operational or non-combat loss during wartime. People had tried to establish in peacetime, we can expect so much attrition of airframes. But it turns out in wartime that just really wasn't the case, because you have all sorts of very different variables going on. So, for example, if you have, at one end of things, you could have a really reliable, solid aircraft like the Dauntless, ironic enough, given the picture in this particular case. But you could have an experienced air group, and their bombing and scouting units are flying Dauntlesses, and they're working up and keeping their eye in, but otherwise everything is fine. And you would expect, therefore, you would have a very low rate of operational losses as a result. You might have the odds thing of this tire flew off for no reason and ended up over the side of the Enterprise like this, or someone just has a very bad day and stuffs up their landing. But generally, things would be pretty calm. At the same time, you could have another carrier operating a mile away, and they might have a very green carrier air group that's just been embarked, and they're trying to learn how to fly the SB2U Vindicator, and you will have a staggering level of operational losses as a result of that. And then, of course, is this an air group that has completed its carrier qualifications and is deployed and is just keeping up the flight hours while they're waiting for the next big thing to happen? Or is this a carrier air group that is still having to qualify some of its pilots as they deploy from Pearl Harbor or Kure or Liverpool or Scapa or wherever? And are they under a lot of pressure to get a bunch of flight experience because they're going to be in combat in about 3 weeks' time? Obviously, they're going to have a lot more operational losses than the more relaxed version. And of course, even things like weather. If you're a Royal Navy carrier toodling back and forth in the Indian Ocean, then as long as you haven't got slightly anemic early versions of the Barracuda, you're unlikely to suffer that many environmentally related operational losses. If on the other hand, you're having to fly constant air patrols because you're on Arctic convoy escort duty, or you happen to be in Admiral Halsey's command during either Cobra or Viper, you're going to have quite a lot of operational losses building up, even if not, some of those planes didn't have pilots in them at the time. And so the steps that you could take to mitigate losses would obviously depend massively on the environment that you're in and why are these losses taking place. Because, you know, one way of mitigating operational losses might be, hey, how about we strengthen the fuselage of these C-fires so they don't break every other time they land? But another way of mitigating losses would be, you know what, the carrier's pitching about left, right and center like nobody's business. How about we just suspend flight ops and put some additional flight ops on in a few days when the weather calms down? And everything in between. Joao Rita asks, sorry if this has already been asked, but British submarines, why did they have their deck gun in that unusual elevated position? Almost all of them seem to have had a specially elevated platform for the deck gun. So it kind of depends on the submarine in question. Different reasons are put forward for different submarine classes. But some of the more common ones include things like attempts to make retractable guns so that they can have better hydrodynamics underwater. And just a standard deck mounting, there wouldn't be enough space in the casing for the gun and its elevation and retraction mechanism between the pressure hull and the casing. So if you put it on a raised pedestal, which itself hopefully is somewhat fared, then you might get enough space in the combined casing and pedestal height to withdraw the gun. Also, as you might see with these are L-class subs in the early interwar period, the casing might not actually be that wide, so it might be somewhat impractical to put a gun on there because you might not be able to actually slew it round without, you know, leaning over the edge of the casing and ammunition supply issues and so forth. Another issue is rapid access to the gun, because if men are going to come up through the conning tower or the sail to fight the gun and the gun is all the way out somewhere on the casing, then they have to come up, across, down, over, and so that's going to take a while, and then you obviously also have to provide ammunition lockers and everything down there for them to access. Whereas if it's up on a pedestal, or as in the L-class's case, actually up on the sail, that shortens the distance the men need to go to get to the gun, so it can come into action sooner, and potentially you can build in ammunition supplies and so forth more integrated into the shape of the sub. And then another common reason, in fact, probably one of the most common reasons, is a kind of a double element. One is that a gun on a pedestal can be fought in rougher seas than a gun on the casing, which may be awash in said seas. So therefore it has more utility. And there's a sort of a corollary to that and related to it is the tactics that they were expecting to use. So obviously some submarines were built with a deck gun primarily there in mind to shell merchant ships, so you're going to be moving fairly slowly or stopped in a fairly permissive environment. Most British subs, while they were designed with the idea of, yes, they can do commerce warfare, they were perhaps a little bit more designed towards the hunting of enemy warships and other strategic assets as a primary goal, or at least a joint goal. And if you're going to be potentially chasing somebody down, or if you're going after an enemy sub, you're going to be engaging in running combat, then obviously moving through the water faster means, again, more waves coming over the casing. Therefore, an elevated position will allow you to fight your gun in at higher speeds in rougher weather than the enemy if they have a casing-mounted gun. And as a further related part of that, you actually see fairly often, especially in late World War One and early interwar submarine tactics, and to a certain extent in the later interwar as well, there's discussion of if a submarine is engaging in a gun action, rather than coming fully out of the water, like you see here, sort of up to the notional waterline, of instead remaining partially submerged to keep the pressure hull and most of the casing either at or below the waterline, because that makes you a less easy target and of course gives you the water to protect you in the event of a shell falling slightly shorter than dropping through the water to hit you. And if you're going to do that, then again, a casing-mounted gun isn't much use because your men will be up to their waist in water, whereas a pedestal-mounted gun or a sail-mounted gun, you can, in theory, fight that from a relatively nice dry position while keeping most of your hull either semi-submerged or fully submerged, and thus you're a much harder target for your opponent. Candor asks, if you had to build a battleship design for the Royal Navy post-World War II, but with a view to it having the longest possible useful life past the end of where the channel covers, what would you build? Hindsight being limited to being able to foresee the broad strokes of technical progress rather than specific events. Honestly, I would probably be designing something like this. And before you go, oh, yes, Drac, you and your all forward stuff. This isn't too far removed from what actually a few designs post-1945 for the Royal Navy actually were. I did a whole video on, you know, the post-World War II battleship designs, and you'll see some of those there. So what have we got here? We've got two quadruple 15-inch up front. So I'm taking the view of it's not worth developing a 16-inch gun in the post-World War II environment. But hey, look, we're decommissioning an absolute metric ton of ships armed with 15-inch guns. And we know from the various refits that we can refit and upgrade them to be pretty decent guns. So we'll have a massive pool of them. And honestly, our opponents, likely opponents at least, don't have any battleships. So the fact that the 15-inch 42, even heavily upgraded, isn't the heaviest hitting battleship gun of all time anymore doesn't really make much odds, because these things will chew through Sverdlovs or even Stalingrads if they get built more than happily. So what we're doing is essentially upscaling the KGV's 14-inch quad, working out some of the issues, which obviously they've had time to do during the Second World War, and just having our 8-gun up front salvo. Now, in terms of the anti-aircraft armament, you can see we have 5 twin 4.5s down either side. That makes for a nice initial anti-aircraft armament. You know, that makes a lot of sense as a heavy AA armament in the immediate post World War II period. You can see we've got two funnels. We've got quite a large machinery space because we are going to be moving along at 33 knots. Got a lot, lots of little smaller AA guns all over the superstructure because this is immediate post-World War II. We've got what looks like the old KGV amidships flight facilities here, but that is not in fact the case. This is purely boat storage. And then bearing in mind what happens with some other ships, amidships flight areas in World War II. Basically, I'm building this in initially as ships boat storage, but with an eye towards we can also basically plate this in to join the fore and aft superstructure together to provide more accommodation space or whatever in the future. And then right aft, we're keeping this area nice and clear and open because helicopters are just starting to come in and they do have their utilities beginning to be demonstrated. So yes, we have our radar, we have our two masts for that, but this aft area is essentially preset, pre-cleared to be a helicopter landing an operation area. Potentially the aft superstructure might include a small hangar for helicopters, particularly for anti-submarine warfare and things like that. So for an immediate post-war ship, this is, by the way, it's displacing about 50,000 tons. It's got a 12-inch thick belt, 6 to 8 inches on the deck, and some fairly heavily armoured turrets. And yes, this isn't anywhere near enough to stop, you know, rocket-powered tall boys and everything, but what I've essentially created this to be immune to is heavy cruiser firepower, Stalingrad-type firepower, basically the kind of surface threats that it's likely to meet that aren't full-on battleships. It's got reasonable immunity at longer range against battleships as well, but also the then current heavy bombs and stuff that you might expect to come in. And I've not tried to go beyond that because that saves weight. So it's immune to basically everything it's likely to face. Yes, if you throw something really, really heavy at it, it will probably go through. But then you're kind of limiting yourself to only throwing the absolute heaviest stuff at it, at which point, you know, my save weight is going into all my other defenses. So hopefully you won't get there in time. And then obviously, in the immediate post-World War II period, they're beginning to think about surface-to-air missiles and so forth. So this would be potentially one of the other uses of this amidships boat deck area. Certainly some of those very early missiles that almost seem to have a above-decks magazine where they'd be churned out very slowly and erected and then fired off. So arc of fire doesn't really matter all that much because they launch straight up and then head off in whatever direction. This could that amidships area could be potentially a launch area for that, or potentially the helicopter deck aft could become a launch area for that. And of course, then that would be the thinking at the time. You know, if we need to invoke missiles, there are two big areas to install missiles. And potentially in the future, if somebody invents something that's designed to replace our heavy AA mounts, well, we've got five twin heavy AA mounts either side ready to accept those changes. So, for example, later on when they develop CCAT, for example, that could slot in quite happily. And if you went even further forward in time and somehow persuaded the Treasury to keep this thing in service to the point where you might be looking to install stuff like CDART and so forth, then again, you've got plenty of space to do that, as well as potentially also keeping helicopters operating, because all the main armament is just all concentrated up front. And that's everything for this video, everybody. A little bit longer than normal. The last write-up was a fraction shorter than normal, but there you go. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed it, and hope to see you again in the next video. And of course, next week, it's Patreon Dry Dock time.